Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I will be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. Normally, when we talk to a CEO, their gauge of success is in some shape or form tied to the profit and loss statement. For today's guest, it's not that the money isn't important, but rather it's what can be done with that money that is the true mark of success. Aisling Hurley has over 35 years' experience in the non-for-profit sector, having started out at the University of Limerick, assisting with the creation of the University of Limerick Foundation. This was followed by a role in CSS Ireland and then the Royal College of Surgeons as Director of Development. In 2012, together with Professor Arnie Hale, a leading breast surgeon, she established Breast Cancer Ireland, securing its charitable status. Since then, BCI has raised over 25 million euros from the public, both from individual and corporate support. Aisling has been awarded many industry accolades as she continues to lead the development and the expansion of Breast Cancer Ireland. Aisling, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Wow, what an intro.
All of it true. That's the thing. Now, I think a good place to start is, what is the vision of Breast Cancer Ireland?
Well, the ultimate vision is to transform the disease from often being a fatal illness. I mean, we do have about 690 deaths annually, but we want to transform that into a treatable long-term illness. In other words, a chronic illness that can be managed and maintained with medicine, with drugs.
Mm-hmm. And where does Breast Cancer Ireland fit in that goal and that vision?
Well, I suppose 10, 12 years ago when we set up Breast Cancer Ireland, one of the key things and the drivers was, you know, how can we make a difference? Will we ever get a cure in my lifetime? And at that point, I kind of scratched my head and thought, we probably won't, not in my lifetime, because there are a lot of different subtype breast cancers. But then as time has gone on and I've seen that one of the key drivers was the need to speed up research, scientific research, so research in the labs. And so we looked at the different 8 designated cancer centres and we said, well, how could we as an independent entity really put clout behind that and make them collaborate with each other? You know, in Ireland, we typically, if we're doing some research, we keep it to ourselves. Mm. We work in silos. We don't want to let our neighbours know what the other one's doing. So we decided we would fund specialist breast research nurses. We put them into the designated cancer centres, and their job was to collaborate with each other and collate all the patient tissue samples into one national biobank that could be accessed by everybody. So slowly but surely, after about 5, 6, 7 years of that, we went from being, say, one designated cancer centre producing a peer-reviewed publication, potentially one paper in, say, 18 to 24 months. Very, very slow. Now we're producing, on average, per centre, about 12 to 14 papers in a 12-month period. And these are peer-reviewed papers where discoveries have been made, which is fantastic. So for my objective was, let's speed up scientific research discovery, but now we need to speed up international clinical trials. We need to get the discovery that was in the lab, put it into clinical trial, work with the pharma companies, and get it out into new targeted drug therapies that can help patients into the future.
And you know, we obviously, the focus for Breast Cancer Ireland is Ireland, but breast cancer is a global thing. So about what is the relationship with, it's obviously Breast Cancer UK, all the way around the world. So what is, you know, is there an alignment between those various organisations? Because you're all chasing the one goal, really.
Absolutely. Is there an alignment? You must create the alignment.
Right.
You know, okay. you reach out the hand of friendship, yeah, and say, look, how can we work together to make things better? And I suppose a couple of years ago, with our team that are based at the Royal College of Surgeons, they developed an international breast cancer symposium, and where they were bringing together the leading minds in the breast cancer research world. So you had scientists coming over from Duke University, from Mayo Clinic, from the University of Chicago, the Ludwig Breast Centre, and from the UK, from Italy. Like, they were coming from everywhere to share experience experiences, not only of successes, but also of challenges. And it was through that symposium that our breast research team formed an alliance with, say, the University of Chicago, the Ludwig Breast Research Center, where they're looking at a particular area within the breast cancer world, which is metastatic disease. And so for those that don't understand metastatic disease, it's where a primary breast cancer has been diagnosed and treated initially, but where a recurrence occurs, where the tumour has escaped the breast area but gone into other major organs of the body. So, for instance, it can go to the lungs, the liver, the spine, and the most challenging is to the brain. So with the University of Chicago in particular, and indeed with UPMC in Pittsburgh, we're looking at ways to see how the teams can come up with barriers to not allow that cancer tumour to go through the brain membrane, because the outcome going to the brain at the moment is not good.
A lot of people will hear non-profit or charity and not realise that ultimately this is, you know, Breast Cancer Ireland is managed like any other business, right? It is a business. You know, tell me the extent of the operations now within Breast Cancer Ireland.
Well, we are a little bit strange in that when you think of Breast Cancer Ireland as a national charity, you think of volume, you think of loads of people, lots of departments, lots of hierarchy and structures to work within. We have a team of three permanent staff, and we have externally, we have part-time people who work on our education and outreach programme. They work on our fashion relief area. So we have about 10 others. And then we subcontract and have service agreements with, say, our finance people, our HR, our digital people. So in all, there's a big support service there. But there are three people who are running, two and somebody who looks after our administration. Why don't we expand? We could expand, but I suppose the nature of the beast of my personality and those who work with me is, you know, I like to keep things tight. I like to keep things under control. I'm quite frugal. So all of that doesn't lend itself to having big organisations.
And structures, yeah. But, you know, the other side, I suppose, it is that makes you somewhat differently. Like, most CEOs will have to deal with their staff, okay? But you have staff to deal with. And volunteers, right? And I think the volunteer side of it probably creates a whole different dynamic.
But volunteers are really, really fabulous because they either have gone through a breast cancer diagnosis or they're related to people who have gone through a breast cancer diagnosis. And I think once they understand where we come from as an entity, what our, I suppose, ethos and our values and our governance is like, they very much understand the messaging and the tone of how we speak. And that's when we allow them to talk to others on our behalf. But it's something that you have to manage very carefully because it's the tone and messaging in relation to breast cancer as a diagnosis is crucial.
Was it always going to be the non-profit sector for you?
Genie Max, was it always? In an ideal world, I'd love to be running big, big companies and earning massive, massive salaries. You know, if you look at non-profits.
Yeah, but would you be as satisfied? That's the question. Would it give as much job satisfaction?
Probably not. It's funny because when I started at the University of Limerick way back, too long ago to remember, I had only just qualified. And I remember my father saying to me, I'm one of six girls, and him saying to me, now, what are you going to do with your business degree? And I remember thinking, I haven't got a clue. I don't know, what can I do with it? So I went and walked, I was from Limerick, so I went and walked all the various industrial estates, knocking on doors saying, here's my CV, hire me, I'll do anything, whatever. I had done my internship in a company called Helmedica, which is now Stryker, in their purchasing department. And I kind of thought, well, no, I don't really want to do purchasing, but I could do something like marketing. So lo and behold, a recruitment company that I had put my CV in with in Limerick contacted me to say that this was a new job, very new to Ireland, nobody else was doing it. This was an opportunity to really grow within this company. There was only going to be an American consultant was coming in and I was going to work alongside him to develop what is the University of Limerick Foundation. So I thought about it and I thought, well, yeah, that's kind of cool. You know, we researched these wealthy Irish Americans and we'll look and see how we can match the needs of the university with some of these people and their interests. And I jumped into it and it was, you know, it wasn't 9 to 5. It was like 9 to 12 in the evening because I was dealing with the States.
Yeah.
But I loved every minute of it. The only thing is my father did say to me at the time, you know, he scratched his head thinking, how are you with a degree under your belt? Why would you stand on a corner shaking a bucket and sticking stickers on people? And I was going, no, you don't understand. It's not going to be that type of fundraising. This other big, big fundraising. And he said, but why would they give to a little university that's now only just turned a university because it went from NIHE to the University of Limerick. And I said, because there's lots of potential. There's naming opportunities, there's endowed scholarships, et cetera, et cetera. Anyhow, roll on. I was there, oh, maybe 6-7 years. My husband was headhunted to run a Japanese company here in Dublin. And he kind of said, look, I'll go for 3 years. We'll come back to Limerick. All will be well. That didn't happen. Because I then left. I had had one baby. She was two. I was due my second. And I kind of said, well, I'm going to go to Dublin. And the only thing I said was, OK, I promise I won't work in another university structure, because now all the universities, Trinity and DCU and all these, were also now looking at fundraising in a very significant way. So I joined, as you say, CCS, which is a consultancy firm, an American consultancy firm. And I worked on loads of different variety of projects, Trocra, the ARC, you know, all different types and levels of fundraising programs. And I loved it. And then number three was arriving. So, you know, you're working in an American company that didn't have maternity leave. So I went out on my own. And then that's when I did a program for CSI. I think any program I've got involved in, I throw myself into it. I wouldn't stay in it if I didn't like it.
Yeah.
And I suppose when Breast Cancer Ireland, which was originally an account within the bank for Grateful Patients of Arnie Hills, and we suddenly decided to put a structure and governance and manners on it. And I love it. I mean, my own kids say to me, who are now adults, you know, when are you going to retire, Mum? Like, when are you going to actually step back? And that shocks me and frightens me, because, like, this is my baby. So I don't know is the answer.
And have you ever come, or even thought about, or come very close to going in a completely different direction? Do you think that once that kind of stint, and you convinced your dad that you weren't going to be shaking money boxes on the corner, that this was the route for you, that this is where you saw it?
I've just loved doing what I do.
Yeah.
And I suppose with 35 plus years experience, I'm very passionate about it. I know the ins and outs. I know the pitfalls. I know the successes that are there. I can speak 100% as the expert in the area that I'm in. I might feel a little bit daunted stepping into something else, but I think the background and basis that I have is I have the knowledge of sales, marketing, finance. So I do feel I could step into another role. I've never been tempted.
What I suppose, as I said, going back to the introduction, when I talked to a CEO of a for-profit company, right, the question of what does success look like is kind of obvious, right? But for you, what does success look like?
Well, first and foremost, I've got to raise the money. So I've always got a target in my head as to where I want to be and what I want to achieve financially, because there are commitments that I've made over the years for various different research grants. I love, success for me is when I have given grants to big institutions that are making and producing an impact. So they're really seeing the benefit of the funding that they're getting, and I'm seeing the impact it can have on patients. For instance, we have made a grant about a year ago for a new trial called the Shamrock Trial. And this is a trial looking at a subtype breast cancer called HER2 positive, which is quite prevalent amongst women. That's the type of diagnosis they might get. And we're looking at patients that get a recurrence of this subtype, and we are now looking at giving them a fourth generation drug called duroxetine along with initial chemotherapy, and the idea being that they would reduce and de-escalate the need for chemotherapy after 1 month, let the drug work its magic, and the ultimate end game is 100% response rate. If that happens in 2 to 3 years' time, then for me, that is a little tick box on my calendar of a cure for that particular subtype breast cancer.
It's more than a little tick box, though.
No, it's massive.
Yeah.
But that's so exciting.
Yeah.
And that's where I kind of go, that's why I do it. That's why the money we raise is so important, because we're giving it to these scientists.
It's the means to the end.
They need it. You know, we can't stand still. I look and I say to people all the time, look at the global pandemic. The world rallied. We got a certain amount of COVID vaccines, and we, you know, we helped prevent massive, massive illness and sickness and death. We can do the same in the breast cancer world and in all the various chronic illnesses, but we just need to support them and to invest in them. We can't stay static.
Do you self-analyse yourself and your decisions in the business?
Yes and no. I do certainly look at things and I say, you know, well, I do the what if. If I go this route, this and this can happen. But if I go that route, then that might happen. And then I weigh it up. And I'm very much a person of, you know, I'm not adverse to risk. I do manage it, and I do sort of do my own due diligence on certain things. And I have in my own arsenal my mentor, and he's so straight and level headed. He would challenge me a lot of the times, but then, you know, if it's right, it's right. If it's wrong, then it's wrong.
There's a great saying in the business world, you know, if you want someone to act like the owner of a business, you need to make them the owner of a business, right? But how do you see ownership in the context of a non-profit organization, you know? Like, what is the end game for Aisling Hurley in this? Like, you know, if you're an entrepreneur and you set up a business, you sell it on, or you give it on to your next generation, or you do some, there's a process, there's a step. Mm-hmm. You know, your kids asked you, are you really going to retire? But, you know, what does retirement look like? So, you know, you own this because it's part of you,
yeah,
right? So what happens when you want to hang up your pink socks and go, no, thanks very much?
Yeah. Well, I suppose nobody is the be-all and end-all. Mm. You know, there has to be succession. There has to be somebody that'll take up the mantle and run with it. My hope is that, you know, when and if the time comes that I do decide to step aside, that the entity can be run the way I see it should be run, and that somebody will come in and somebody will have a vision and the passion to drive it forward and expand it. I mean, there are times I doubt myself and I say, you know, is it time for me to step aside and give somebody else the mantle and let them really run it? Mm. You know, am I the best person for the job? You know, I created it. But like, you, as you go through things and years on in, you do have to question and say, you know, while things are working and things are very successful, but could we do better?
Mm. In that case, then, what's the hardest part of the job as CEO of Breast Cancer Ireland?
I suppose it's that little person on my shoulder wondering, am I doing as much as I could do? Mm. Could I do more? Should I do more? Should I take that leap of faith and, you know, take more people in, build up the annual income, double, triple what it is? Could it then be managed to that level? And I think that's an area that, and it's something we're currently looking at. I just came from a board meeting last night, in actual fact, where we are talking about that, because I was putting it to them going, I do believe that there is more to be done. Mm-hmm. With such a small team, it's hard to get all of that done. And I think that there is merit in considering expanding it out.
Yeah. You know, CEOs have their shareholders to deal with, okay? But you have both. Who do you see as your shareholders or your stakeholders in the organisation?
Wow. Okay, well, my governance stakeholder or shareholder is my board.
Yeah.
So I'm answerable to the board that's there.
Yeah.
I've got to justify why I do certain things, and, you know, when revenue comes in and I'm looking at, you talk about profit and loss, and I have to look at the bottom line always. So I am answerable to them in that respect. Then I have to look at my community, the breast cancer community are my stakeholders, because they're the ones that get me to where I need to go financially when I'm trying to raise money. So I suppose if I roll back to, say, March of 2020, when the doors ultimately were shut because of COVID, we were at that time a very, very physical event driven entity. So we relied a lot on our funding from, say, the likes of our Pink Run, which is a massive event, from the likes of, we used to run a Battle of the Stars, golf classics, things like that, that were very physical events. And all of a sudden, that was finished. So then I had to look and say, okay, now what am I going to do to get the monies in? At that point, I say I was in the year, was probably 1.5 million in. And I was thinking, well, I need another million or 1.5 million. Where am I going to get it from? So all of a sudden, I looked at the online community and I looked at digital. And prior to that, I was quite ad hoc, myself and the development manager. We would kind of post things as we saw things coming up. So I thought, well, I definitely need to be more online. I need more focus there. So I developed a brief, and I decided I would tender it out to a number of agencies, digital agencies, to just say, you know, here we are, blank canvas. This is what our vision, our mission, our goals are. Here's the pillars that we work within. This is my ultimate end target goal. How can I get there in an online world? And to be fair, we went with one particular agency, and they definitely put manners on us and structure, you know, with us, so that it then allowed me to focus on what they then required from me. We did a research survey with our stakeholders online going, you know, what do you want to hear? What do you want to see? And interestingly, they came back saying, well, we don't really want to see all the fabulous ambassadors that you have. Mm. We want to see more real people. We want to hear their real stories. But we also want to hear from your research teams in English what are they doing and how are they making impact and how can we help more?
Mm-hmm. And do you think, you know, when you look back at the whole COVID thing and what has come out of it in terms of that digital, to a large extent, that wouldn't have happened if COVID hadn't happened, because you'd have continued on doing your physical events and all about that thing.
Yeah.
You know? So when you look at that, when you look at that learning, I suppose it comes back to that idea of bringing in maybe some other bodies that might just germinate ideas and come through it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I suppose, like, we went from a point of view of online donations of about 9,000 a year to over 300,000 during COVID. Mm-hmm. It was phenomenal, the response we got. So much so that in April, I was filling out the community fund in Ireland through the government was saying, you know, charities that didn't expect their revenue to be where it should be could apply for this grant. And I thought, okay. And I sat down and I went through like 12 pages writing up the scenarios of where we are and what we could do. I submitted it. And then I think at the coming into, say, July and August, when I knew that my income was even more than what I had planned for, especially during COVID, which was fantastic, I was awarded 100,000 euros from this grant. And I sort of looked at it and went, and as people who do know me would look at me and go, no way are you giving that back. And I kind of thought, well, no, I need to give that back because we don't need it now. And I know that there's lots of entities out there who really are struggling and they really do need it. So I remember contacting them and they said to me, oh, you want to give it back? And I said, well, yes, I need to give it back to you. I don't need it now. Yeah. There's others who definitely do. So, and the board were, you know, scratching their head initially about that, but it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. But it just showed me that, you know, we didn't need to rely as much on physical events. It has made me a lot more wary going forward of the need to always think you have to have a physical event. There are certain things I absolutely have to do. The Pink Run was one that it is such an emotive event, you know, where thousands of people come together and they are like your pink tribe. Mm-hmm. They were devastated when they couldn't do the Pink Run during COVID. And in actual fact, we made it virtual for them to do it within their 5 kilometre radius. And it raised over €1 million, which was phenomenal. Now they want to come back. They want to come back in a physical sense because it's of that
community.
Camaraderie. Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
It's community. And it's not just about a community of people who have suffered from breast cancer, but it's every step on.
And that's what I would always say when I talk about it's now the Very Pink Run. Thank you. Thanks to our new sponsor, the Very Group. But now that I talk about the run, it's very much about men, women and children. It's not about, you know, women only, because everybody is impacted by a breast cancer diagnosis, whether it is father, mother, whether it's father, brother, aunts, uncles, friends down the road, your colleagues in work. And I always say that this is an opportunity to come together, show your support for these people and give something back to the research world.
Yeah. You mentioned your sponsor and Very have come on board. I had to look up who they were. I'm not going to lie to you. But talk to me about the relationship with sponsors and, you know, getting new ones and ensuring, if you will, the cultural alignment with the BCI goals and who your sponsor is.
Mm-hmm. That's really important. And it's, I suppose, something that we look at, you know, every year when we sit down and do our strategic planning. It's about seeing, well, who's out there that aligns with our values and our ethos and our ethics and our vision of where we want to go, and how can we bring them on the journey to support us. And it came about, we had a meeting with Very back in the end of July, and we were talking about sort of 2024. I wasn't thinking about the Pink Run for 2023. And just as we started to talk about all the various things that we do and the impact we can have, they suddenly said, you know, we'd love to, is that open for title sponsorship? Now, we were very fortunate in that for the previous 10 years, Glanby has always been our rock. And their business model has changed slightly in relation to their employees that are currently on the ground. And while they want to stay involved and stay supportive financially as well as their employee engagement, but at a lower level. And I had said this year in 23, well, we'll leave it anyway, you'll still be there and I'll move on for 24 and beyond. But then Very said, look, we'd love to take it. And we'd love to take this title sponsorship for 3 years because we love what you do. We love the impact you have. They as an entity have a huge female base of support within a certain target audience range that they felt was very aligned with where Breast Cancer Ireland was.
And when you think about that kind of getting together, presumably, and we've seen a big move within the corporate world with, you know, the whole corporate social responsibility, and a lot of companies are wanting to get involved with it for various different reasons. Is that opening up an awful lot of opportunities now for you as you think about, you know, obviously the Very Pink Run is now done, but you've other things, that other marquee events that suddenly, you know, why wouldn't somebody else come in?
Absolutely. And I think what has helped us hugely is we set up about 6 years ago an education and awareness piece. So I suppose 80% of my time would be in raising funds to support research, because that's critical. But the other 20%, I noticed a lot of younger women were being diagnosed with breast cancer. And they were women sort of between the ages of 20 and 50. There's about 24% of those women are diagnosed with breast cancer. And when I did some research on it and we did a survey amongst a group of women, we, with dire consequences, I realised that while 80 or 90% of them realised breast cancer was a terrible disease, they thought it was a lump and nothing more. They thought that they were checking themselves, but they weren't doing it on a regular basis. And they really felt that the government's breast check agency at the age of 50, where they would get their free mammo, was enough. So shock and horror, I went, oh my God, we have to change that culture. Because when I look at survival rates in Northern European countries, they're at like 95, 96%. And aside from all the research and the medical side of it, I questioned why these women were living longer and why their survival was better.
Early intervention.
Earlier detection and earlier education. Mm. They were educated from at the time they left school on how to do a self-breast examination, knowing the 8 signs and symptoms and getting themselves checked regularly. So we decided, with the support of Cornmarket Group Financial Services, they came on board and they said, well, look, together with the INTO, we would love you to go to schools. We would love you to talk to schools, you know, TY, 5th and 6th, and explain about good breast health. And I remember way back in the day, you know, the medical teams were going, oh my God, no, you're going to clog up our waiting rooms with pubescent children. Mm. And I was saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to make them understand what good breast health is all about, showing them how to check themselves on a regular basis and knowing the 8 signs and symptoms to look for. I said, I would use them as my social ambassadors to go home to their parents, their moms, their grannies, their aunts, and anyone they know, talking about this particular talk that's happened in school today. And interestingly, we have seen that in, say, a 12-month period, the team that we have on the road, which are our part-time ladies, they cover Leinster, Munster and Connacht. They would say that they would have met maybe 35,000 women and young girls across schools, community groups, companies. And there has been a number of early detected cases as a result. So for me, that is key. That awareness is absolutely critical.
All right, I'll throw one back at you then and say, why should that education be gender specific?
Oh, and it shouldn't. Because when you look at it, and that's what I always say, let the male teachers in, let the boys in, let everybody in. The only time, I suppose, we've had feedback from, say, the younger boys, say, fifth year, sixth year boys sniggering, because we bring in a medical mannequin of a torso of a woman's chest, obviously, because it shows the 8 signs and symptoms, and we ask them to come up and actually check and see, can they feel the lump? Can they see the indentation? Can they see the discharge, etc.? That you have the giggles and the sniggering. But statistically, 1 in 9 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime, but 1 in 1,000 men are diagnosed. I have a case of a man, he's 42, who during COVID contacted me and said, you're not going to believe this. He said, I was out for my run every day, came back, had my shower Friday, noticed had a little bit of a lump, didn't think anything of it. Monday came around, still running, lump still there, went to my GP. To be fair, the GP was so vigilant that he, in turn, in about a week's or 2 weeks' time after going in and out, referred him to the matter, where he was seen by a breast surgeon. And that gentleman has gone on to have a full mastectomy and is now living very well after his cancer diagnosis. But he himself is now shouting from the rooftops about it isn't just women.
Yeah, but it's also, I suppose, you know, every boy has a mother, every boy has a daughter, has a sister, you know.
And that's why, you know, when we approached some of our ambassadors to come on board, the likes of Robbie Henshaw and Josh Vandevleer, Josh's grandmother had had breast cancer, and he approached us to say, listen, I'd like to align with the charity. My grandmother had breast cancer. I have sisters. I have, you know, a girlfriend at the time, now wife. These are the women in my life, and I want to make sure that they look after themselves and are protected. Same with Robbie. You know, he's all sisters and his mom and his grannies and his aunts. So, and they've been great ambassadors, and they take that stigma of it only being a female disease.
Mm-hmm. How important is your clarity of purpose when you're doing the day job, and the good days and the bad days, having that clarity of purpose?
It's really important. And I tell you, what makes me get up in the morning is when I see the case studies and patient supporters that I've got to know and that have become part of our family, our Breast Cancer Ireland family. you build such great relations with them. And I suppose then I look and I've lost one or two, and that has been devastating on me because they've become like family. But it makes me work harder, and it makes me have a much clearer purpose of how, of that end game that I need to get there. Mm. I need to get there because I don't want anybody else to go through it. You know, especially in that metastatic world, which is so devastating when it does go to the brain. Now, there are times in the brain we're able to give certain drugs to help it, but 9 times out of 10, it's not great. Mm-hmm. The outcome is not great, and the longevity is not great. I want that to be better. Mm-hmm. I really, really am focused on getting there. People say, you know, but what about the other subtypes? And we do fund, I fund triple negative breast cancer, which happens at that younger cohort of women, because there has been no research really performed in that area. And they end up as younger women with the age old chemotherapy, radiation and surgery. Mm-hmm. Chemotherapy is toxic. So these are young women who are our childbearing age who have to, alongside their diagnosis, go for fertility treatment, freeze eggs. Mm. So there has to be something else out there for them that is less toxic. And we did a national call out about 2 years ago. And it was a team from Queen's University in Belfast who won the actual tender. And they are currently, they're about to publish their peer review, I think it's in this year, the end of this year, and they hope to go on into clinical trial where they have come up with another targeted therapy instead of chemo to give triple negative mm-hmm. patients. So that is really important for me, alongside the metastatic work that we do, the HER2 work that we do. But it is important just to keep pushing that boundary. And I have a lot of metastatic case studies that are supportive of Breast Cancer Ireland, and I want to give them time. Mm.
Let's talk about, I suppose there's a few things. Crisis management is the big one I want to talk about. And, you know, you have, on the twofold, you have the kind of the negative sentiment about charities that sometimes come around when you hear the charity scandals and things like that. But, you know, and then there's the issues around cervical check, but then there's COVID closing down breast check and things like that. So talk me through those different types of crisis and how you manage through them. And you know, no crisis is ever going to be the same, but what are the learnings that you get out of it?
Mm. I suppose, first and foremost, I am cautious. Mm. My focus is, and it does take quite a lot of my time, is governance. Mm-hmm. I'm very passionate about ensuring that Breast Cancer Ireland is governed very well, that it is transparent and that it is accountable. Mm. And I suppose every year, you know, I have to go through this governance compliance document for the charities regulator. It's about 60 pages long, but it is important that I do it because then at the end of each year, we get awarded our triple lock. Mm-hmm. And there are 9,000 charities in the country, 72 are triple locked. And I suppose in relation to Very, if I go back to Very, Very Group, one of the key reasons that they could make a decision so quickly was based on us being triple locked. Their due diligence was done. That was great. They didn't need to worry about anything else bar focus on what was mm-hmm. on the table. So crisis management, I suppose in relation to, if I look at certain charities and I suppose they have muddied the waters mm-hmm. for the rest of us. It upsets me because mm-hmm. unfortunately, as a nation, we tend to say, oh, all charities are the same, and they're actually not. Yeah. I think that it's where governance comes into play, and it's where, thankfully, now that the regulator is in place, there is more stringent oversight on charities. Mm. And if charities aren't performing, they are pulled up over it. And I welcome that.
Mm. Let's talk on governance. What type of people do you need on a non-profit board? When you think about your board and you think of everything that you have to deal with and think, you want people with expertise in it. So if you were to put together the Manchester City version of a charity board, what would it look like?
Munster Rugby. Let's take soccer out.
Let's go with Munster Rugby. I'll give you that.
No, I agree. You definitely need a skill base. So yeah. You need somebody that is, you know, an expert in legal. You need, ideally, legal, finance, marketing stroke digital is great, strategic development and sort of entrepreneurial skills. they're kind of the mix. And actually, Breast Cancer Ireland at the moment, we are expanding our board profile. We've had three new directors join us recently, and they are fantastic breath of fresh air. Mm-hmm. And they are challenging, which is great. And it brings that sense of excitement back into the board, where you're now seeing people who would say, but why? And how come? And what if? And that, for me, is a really, really positive mm-hmm. sign.
And aligned to that then is how important ultimately is that your board is aligned with your vision as the CEO of the organisation and the vision of the organisation as a whole.
Yeah, that's very important. Mm. Anytime we go and anybody we have decided to approach to come onto the board of Breast Cancer Ireland, there have either been a supporter and a long time supporter of the charity. Mm-hmm. So they understand a little bit about us, but they don't understand the mechanics of how it all, how the wheels turn. Mm-hmm. So it is very much, we sort of try to, if you like, train them or give them a recruitment day and an induction into who we are and what we are and what we do on an annual basis, why we do it, the revenue streams that we get from it, and some of the challenges we face and the new, I suppose, avenues we want to explore. Mm-hmm. And having them on board, if they've been successful in their own business, which 9 times out of 10, we're bringing people in who are very successful, who have a good network of people that they can also talk to. That's really important in a board, because you want board members to not just show up. You want them to actively get involved and understand the message.
Whether you like it or not, in a way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, if I'm asked to go on a board, I have to look at, do I have time? Because I can't just show up. I will need to give my input. Mm. I will need to get off my backside and help them in some way. And what can I do to help them? And I think each and every one of them has looked at it from that perspective. And I remember when I was in the University of Limerick Foundation, it was a case of, I need you to show up at 4 meetings a year. I need you to make a major gift. Mm. I need you to open doors to X, Y, and Z. And if you're willing to do all of those things, then I'd love to welcome you on board. Right. And that was the straight up question that was always asked. And people would say, well, I can show up 4 times a year, I can do this. What size of a 6-figure gift do you want? You know, so those were the kind of things that you have to deal with straight up first, because I often find if you're going to come on a board, unless you give first, you can't go and expect others to give.
Yeah, yeah. Do you obsess about the small things?
I try not to.
So you do.
But that's a lie. I do. Yeah, I do. I do. I try not to, but I do. I do.
You obviously do. Obviously, you know, you've dealt with a lot of executives and things like that in terms of sponsorship and all of that. What have you learned from other executives or other or companies or other non-profit organisations that you see? And do you actively try to bring some of that into the Breast Cancer Ireland?
I suppose in dealing with sponsors, our biggest foray was maybe whenever, 8 or 10 years ago when we started to talk to Glanbia. Glanbia, massive company, they had a lot of requirements that we had to say, yes, we would adhere to, you know, that we would follow their direction on. Then it became sort of, we had to have terms of agreement, license agreements, contracts drawn up. That was a whole new area for me. But again, because I have legal people who I can go to and say, well, what do you think? And are we covered here? And is everything going to work out there? They have loved the relationship together as well, because not only are, and this is something that people often don't realise, is that when we get sponsorship, financial sponsorship is one thing, but getting a sponsor on board who's really aligned with what you want to do and really wants to help from their CSR point of view with their employees and their stakeholders, aligning to what we're trying to do is magical. Mm. And it really shows that teamwork and that team effort that goes in every year. And we've had amazing successes. We do our breast health sessions in so many companies with our sponsors there. They come on site to help us with some of our bigger events, with volunteering and marshalling at the events. So it works every which way.
Yeah, win-win for everyone. Mm. Now, the final thing is the final question, and I'm opening up the black book here as is our tradition. Oh, I actually have to say I've been very lucky, right, in terms of the questions I've asked people, that they've all somehow or other fitted everybody, right? But this one, I think this one fits you, right? And I'll throw it open and wide so you can do anything you like. If you could change one thing, what would it be and why?
If I could change one thing.
One thing, yeah.
Oh, it's so difficult. If I think about it personally, it would be to try and have a better work-life balance. Mm-hmm. because I am, it's all or nothing. So I am Breast Cancer Ireland from dusk to dawn. Mm-hmm. There is that element of you need to have a cutoff point. So if there was one change, it is a work-life balance. I would like a better work-life balance.
Mm-hmm. And from a Breast Cancer Ireland thing? I'll allow you put in the cure breast cancer.
Oh, yeah. I would love that. I really would love that. I get excited by new clinical trials. And when I, especially this Shamrock trial, I'm really excited about that because I think that is definitely going to be a game changer. Mm-hmm. And if we can have more investment, then I can have more clinical trials mm-hmm. that equally could be game changers. And I will get to that point where we will keep everybody alive and they'll live happy lives, but they'll live with a cancer diagnosis, but they will live.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I would just like to thank my guest, Aislinn Hurley. Remember, folks, that you don't have to wait for events like the Very Pink Run to give money to Breast Cancer of Ireland. So as they say, donate early and donate often. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.